Welcome back to the Wall Street Shuffle. We have Walter Block on the line with us. Walter is an economics professor at Loyola University and author of Privatization of Roads and Highways and Defending the Undefendable. Walter, how are you, my friend?
I'm delighted to be with you on your show.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. You are so polite. Most people are not anywhere near that polite. Thank you so much, my friend. You have such provocative topics. For example, privatizing rivers. What the heck is that all about?
Well, I'm from New Orleans, and recently a government river killed a lot of people. I'm talking about Katrina.
Sure.
And the Army Corps of Engineers, which is a governmental enterprise, and the U.S. government, which owns the Mississippi River, between the two of them killed about 1,500 of my fellow citizens, and I'm not much of a fan of that. And my thought is that if the river was owned by the Mississippi River Corporation, a private entity, they would take better care of their property than the government would.
Yeah.
But then the argument comes right back at you that Transocean didn't do that on the oil rig. So I guess that goes both ways.
Transocean?
Yeah, that was a private company, right? Lack of regulation. 11 people died, and now it's turning into the largest ecological disaster in history.
Did we
in the
bring
Gulf.
You in to shoot the guest wheels off? Did we do that?
No, I just wanted to bring the other side
You're
of
right.
the
You're
argument.
You've been gone too long.
Yeah. Anyways, continue. But is that not a valid point as well?
We're now talking about the BP oil spill in the Gulf.
Yes.
Guess who claims ownership of the Gulf?
Good question. Who is that?
It's the government.
Oh, I see.
And if the Gulf were privately owned, they would have been much more careful, presumably, than in who they allowed to drill in their water, because they would know that they'd be responsible. Whereas right now, the government, in its infinite wisdom, has seen to it that BP is not going to be responsible for all of the damage caused, but only up to, I think, $75
million. Yeah, $95 million.
Oh, $95 million, sorry. Plus the cost of cleanup. So I think a private enterprise who owned the Gulf of Mexico would have been a little bit more careful, because if they make a mistake, they can go broke, whereas if the government makes a mistake, it just raises our taxes. So unless we embrace socialism, and we've seen what happened with the Soviet Union, we should embrace free enterprise.
Well, let's just assume, first of all, you are one of my favorites, because instead of being a Keynesian economist, you're an Austrian economist, as am I. And a libertarian theorist. I happen to subscribe to the libertarian theory. So you and I are exactly on the same page. And what you're really talking about is letting the free market control everything. Now, and I agree with that. But let me ask you a question. When it comes to Wall Street, Greenspan said the same thing. He thought that the inherent greed of people on Wall Street would be self-regulating. It turns out it wasn't. How do you reconcile our theory about Austrian economics and libertarianism with greed?
Well, as Adam Smith said about greed, it's not from benevolence that the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker give us their products. It's out of a keen appreciation of their own selfish interest and greed. As long as we have markets, free enterprise, this is fine. The magic of the marketplace, as Ronald Reagan used to talk about, converts greed and selfishness into good works. But the problem is, when you don't have private property, or when you have government regulations, or when you have a central bank like the Fed, of which Greenspan and now Bernanke are head of, well, then you don't have free enterprise. And of course the system isn't going to work if you have a large admixture of socialism or fascism. It only works when you have free enterprise.
So are you saying that had there been, and I struggle with this, because I think the avarice on Wall Street is beyond belief, and how blatant it is. I guess you could say that back in the early 90s, before the government said we need to encourage more home ownership, if the government hadn't become involved in the whole prime subprime process, getting more homes to the people that can't afford it, if we hadn't gotten involved in that, I guess you're saying we never would have gotten to 2006 through 2008. And the system would have been self-regulating. I'd like to believe that greed would have regulated the system. It seems to me that greed would have taken us right off the same cliff.
Well, when you shop for a car, do you try to buy the cheapest car you can get, or do you
Never.
Try to buy the most expensive car of the things you can?
Every chance I get.
I'm sure you try to. If there are two cars that are identical and one is selling for $30,000 and one is selling for $35,000, you greedy person, don't you grab the $30,000 one?
Actually, I prefer the $50,000 one selling for $30,000, but yes, your point's well taken.
Well, the point is that everyone is greedy. The avarice is no monopoly of Wall Street. Every last person wants to buy at the lowest price and sell at the highest price. So what is this Wall Street greed? This greed all over.
Well, no, I agree with that. But when we're talking about things like, let's say the subprime mess, the derivatives, the $1.5 quadrillion worth of completely unmatched derivatives floating around out there, people have created instruments of absolutely no value to anybody in society, pocketed the fees on them, left nothing behind but carnage, and walked away. Now you've taken greed to a whole new level. Do we need regulation for that, or would just completely eliminating regulation of Wall Street to serve us better?
Well, I think we need to eliminate regulation because the cause of the problem is, as you say, the subprime mortgages, letting people into houses that never could have gotten into before under the old stricter rules of, you know, you have to have collateral and you have to have a credit rating. But I think that the Federal Reserve System also deserves a big dollop of blame for this crisis.
Oh, absolutely.
The Fed came in 1913, and if you look at the roughly 100 years before and after the Fed came in, where right now we're roughly 100 years later, the business cycle has been going like a cyclone ever since they got into it. Whereas before, even though there was still some government regulation which caused the cycles before that, but afterward it's gigantic. So I think you're really on the wrong foot when you blame greed or avarice or anything like that. What you have to do is look for government intervention which screws up the market. These people have been artificially lowering interest rates, thus encouraging malinvestments, misallocations of resources, and that's what causes the bubble, not derivatives or any of these other Wall Street financial.
If you're saying could we do without a central bank, I contend the Treasury could do what the central bank can do. And I think the central bank's role in supposedly eliminating these positive and negative spikes in our economy, they haven't been able to do it since 1913. They're not able to do it now, and I think they're exacerbating the problem, would be my humble opinion.
It's not really even that they're not able to stop it or that they're exacerbating. They're causing the whole thing.
Yep.
If we have the gold standard, which Ron Paul is favoring, and I certainly support him on that, I don't say we'd have no cycle. There are variations. Supply and demand don't always equal necessarily totally all the time, but there wouldn't be any of this topsy-turvy stuff. So the cause of it is not avarice or greed derivatives or anything like that. Rather, the cause of it is government intervention into the economy, specifically in the present case by the toxic assets that are based on mortgages that never should have been granted, and the Fed.
Walter, I want to ask a very quick question, a little bit of a right turn here. I get a lot of callers ask me what the difference between the Keynesian economist and an Austrian economist. They always hear the word Keynes, and they assume that if they can say the word, that they must be really, really smart people because they know the name of an economist. Nobody really even knows what the Ludwig von Mises Institute is or about Austrian economists. Could you give us like a brief insight into the difference between the two?
Well, let me just it's a very big question, so let me just start with the macro parts of it because that's what we're now discussing. The Keynesians believe that the economy is sort of like a car, and when we are down, depressed, dispirited, our animal spirits are depressed, well, then what the government has got to do is press the gas. On the other hand, when our animal spirits are crawling up toward the roof and we're very excited, then what the government has to do is press the brakes, because the market does not have within itself a regulatory device that keeps us on an even keel. Now, there are two branches of Keynesianism. There's the fiscalists, mainly associated with Harvard and MIT, and then there are the monetarist Keynesians, mainly associated with Milton Friedman and the University of Chicago. And the only difference between them, they're both Keynesians, is that the one believes that the gas pedal and the brake should be fiscal, tax and spending policy, and the other believes that it should be monetary policy.
So how are the Austrians different?
The Austrians differ because we believe that within the bowels of the economy there are self-regulating mechanisms that keep us on an even keel, and government is not needed to to keep us on an even keel, but rather what government does is it screws things up. Animal spirits, I mean, this is sort of a psychiatric view of the economy, the Keynesian view, that, you know, we're either depressed or exuberant, and there's no way out of reconciling these two. But in the Austrian view, the market is a self-regulating institution, and it's not given to bouts of depression or exuberance. And if there is any excess exuberance or the opposite, the profit and loss system will take care of that.
All right, I've got to add, I don't want to, we're going to run out of time here pretty soon. I got about 2 or 3 minutes left. I have to ask you about voluntary slave contracts. What are you talking about?
Well, suppose my child is in horrible disease and it'll take $10 million to cure him. And I value his life more than my own freedom. And you are a very rich man and you've long wanted to have me as a slave. And then you could, you know, whip me into shape on Keynesianism or whatever you wanted to do. So we make the following deal. I will sell myself into slavery to you for $10 million. You give me the $10 million. I turn it over to my son's doctors and they cure him. And then I become your slave. Now, this is very different than the slavery that existed until 1865, which was coercive slavery. We're now talking about voluntary slavery.
Sounds like life settlements to me.
I'm sorry?
Sorry, making a joke. It sounds like life settlements to me.
Well, I think all voluntary contracts are mutually beneficial. I gain because I value my son's life more than my freedom. You gain because you value me as a slave more than the $10 million. So why should that be prohibited by law? I see no reason for it.
So then I can only assume that prostitution is okay with you on that. And I'm not making a judgment call on that. I'm actually kind of sort of, you know, I'm open-minded on that. Only because people should have the right to do what they want to do. And I'm very much a libertarian in that regard.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't want my daughter to be a prostitute or my wife or my mother or any. I really oppose prostitution. I think that sex between consenting adults should be based on love and, you know, affection, not on money. But I'm not going to be putting people in jail for voluntary consensual activity between consenting adults. I think that's wrong.
Yeah, and the people here in the control room and our studio are cringing right now that I just said that. Let me be perfectly clear what I mean. I am not promoting prostitution. What I'm trying to suggest is that if you Danny's handing me notes right in the middle. What are you handing me?
No, go ahead.
Okay. The idea – lost my train of thought. Sorry. Hold on. What do you got, Danny?
I think we agree that we're not favoring prostitution, and there's a big difference between favoring prostitution – and favoring the legalization of prostitution. It's the same thing with drugs like marijuana, cocaine, whatever. I oppose the use of those things. I think they're dangerous substances, but I don't want to be putting people in jail for putting crap into their own bodies, that is adults. I think the libertarian analysis on both is clear, and we have to make clear that we don't favor marijuana or heroin use. We don't favor prostitution. We just oppose the prohibition of it and putting people in jail.
I think that's the problem that I have with this whole process. We can make our own moral judgments based upon our own principles, and that's fine. But the minute that our government starts making moral choices for us in our own personal lives, then you're ceding so much control on a slippery slope to a government. That's the problem that I have. And so what I might choose morally not to do, I don't want the government to tell me that I can't do it.
Or prohibit you, right? I mean, they can talk all they want. Obama or Bush can get up on their hind legs and talk all they want. I don't care. It's just when the police come and put you in jail for capitalist acts between consenting adults, then it's not a slippery slope. The slope has already arrived.
Danny was handing me a note here. Let me get to this real quick, and then we really do need to go to a quick break. He was asking me about drug policy economics. So how do you stand on drug legalization?
Well, I certainly favor drug legalization, even though I don't approve of drugs. And look at what's happening in Arizona now and Mexico. I mean, some people say that the drug gangs are even stronger than the Mexican government, and that can happen in the U.S. too. The reason for this crime is not because of drugs, it's because of the prohibition of drugs. Look, right now, alcohol is legal. And there's nobody shooting anyone over alcohol, yet a couple of decades ago, when alcohol was illegal, people were dying like flies. They were being shot in the streets of Chicago over alcohol. So we've learned nothing from prohibition of alcohol because we've got prohibition of drugs, and it's creating the same havoc.
You have our own little in-studio pot pimp over here praising you, jumping up and down, doing jumping jacks on what you just said.
I mean, I'm in New Orleans, and there are a lot of young black men that are dying of this, and I go on black TV, and I try to tell these people, you know, forget about affirmative action, forget about welfare. Young black men are dying like flies every day. It's in the Times-Picayune. This is a big problem. And the only solution for it is to legalize it. And, you know, previously over alcohol, it was young Italian men that were shooting each other and being shot. So, you know, this is a horrible situation. Ron Paul happily favors not only legalizing gold, but legalizing pot and legalizing anything that is not a per se violation of rights, like rape or murder or theft.
We love Ron Paul. Ron Paul is one of our regular guests on this show, but I wish he would quit saying, I'm going to get rid of the Department of Defense, the CIA, and the NSA. Please, there are truly people out there that want to kill us. Please don't keep saying those things.
No, but Ron doesn't want to get rid of the Department of Defense. He wants to make it a Department of Defense. Right now it's a Department of Offense.
Yeah, unfortunately, he came on the show and actually said he wanted to get rid of the FBI and NSA once. And it's like, and I love the guy. Don't get me wrong. I love the guy.
We're not talking about the FBI. We're talking about the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
We want this real Department of Defense, namely a very strong defensive army. He doesn't want to go over there. The reason they're over here is because we're over there. Right now, what we've got is an Department of Offense. You know, they used to call it the Department of War or the War Department. That's what it is. And what he wants to do, if I can put words in his mouth, and
yep.
Sure, he would agree with me, is not get rid of the Department of Defense, but make what we've got now defensive.
Yeah, I think that's right. And although I did have a good, very close friend of mine who was a very high-ranking person in the military and the defense intelligence side say that not enough Americans understand why we have bases around the world. And the simple answer is you take it to them before they take it to you.
Hang on.
Let me just finish the point real quick. Their theory is that if you extend if you project the landmass, the power of the United States into Europe, into Asia, into South America, that they've got to get through that first wall of defense before they get to the United States. I'm not suggesting whether that's true or not, but that's a much more palatable explanation than we're just staying there because we like being in Korea, we like being in Germany, and we like being in Iraq. So there is some plausibility to that answer.
I don't think it's very plausible. How would we like it if Switzerland or Portugal or any other country had 800 military bases in foreign countries, in 150 different foreign countries?